This show is a Hopful Media podcast production.
Whether I'm worried about hosting or just giving that perfect gift, creating a delicious holiday for my loved ones is super important to me. From effortless holiday hostings to unforgettable gifts, Omaha Steaks delivers the world's best steak experience. They've always been super convenient in giving me the most high-quality steaks I could ask for, whether for myself or a loved one. Omaha Steaks offers unrivaled quality and variety, and every bite is backed by their 100% guarantee. Save big on gourmet gifts and more holiday favorites with Omaha Steaks. Visit omahasteaks.com, and for an extra $35 off, use code YUM at checkout. Terms apply. See site for details. That's omahasteaks.com, promo code YUM. Go to omahasteaks.com and use code YUM at checkout for an extra $35 off. Minimum purchase may apply. See site for details. A big thanks to our advertiser, Omaha Steaks.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to HarlemGlobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the History of Persia. I'm Trevor Cully, and this is episode 151, To Syria, To War. We are so back. Back to the Seleucids, back to the narrative, and kind of back to chronological historical events in general. The last four episodes, spread out as they were, are a sort of mini-series on the Greek Orphic mysteries and eventually their relationship with the developing Zoroastrian sect of Zervanism. The Orphics and Zervanites will return, but for now, we can safely set aside all of that and jump back into one event that comes after another, kings and wars for a little bit. So let's recap. We left off our narrative with the death of Antiochus I Soter. His reign sure was something. Honestly, he's the first long-lasting monarch we've had in a long time, maybe since Xerxes and Artaxerxes I, where I can't really say that his tenure was defined by disaster or success. Antiochus Soter inherited an empire at the height of its power, but still forming and defining its foundations. He abandoned his father's gains in Europe to consolidate power in Asia, but in seizing control of the far larger and wealthier upper satrapies, he gave a series of strategically critical, petty kings in Anatolia time to slip from his grasp. A poorly documented war with Ptolemy II Philadelphus, the first Syrian war, led to some minor shifts in the borders between Egyptian territory in southern Anatolia and northern Syria, but frankly, neither side made any notable gains. After the tidal wave of Gallic invasions swept through Greece and Thrace, they came for the Seleucids, and Antiochus became Soter, the savior of Anatolia, when he successfully defeated the pillaging armies and carved out a new Galatian province in the center of the peninsula. Then, in 266 BCE, Crown Prince and co-king Seleucus attempted to assassinate his father, only to fail and face execution, leading the younger son, another Antiochus, to assume the role of heir apparent. Shortly before his death, Soter lost even more territory with the rebellion and de facto independence of the Anatolian city-state of Pergamon. Then, whether in battle or in bed, Antiochus Soter died in 261 BCE. and Antiochus II became the new Vasileus. King Antiochus II assumed sole power over the Seleucid Empire on June 2, 261 BCE, or thereabouts based on Babylonian records of the time. And when he first settled into his new role, he must have thought he was starting off in a fairly good position, all things considered. Sure, the empire was imperfect, and he was only in the big chair because of his older brother's attempted patricide, but given the circumstances, it looked like a good situation. Unlike many second sons who inherited ultimate power in antiquity, Antiochus II was an adult, in his mid-20s, and he had a few years of practical experience as co-king under his belt. He already had children, including a son who was probably just starting to get clear of the most dangerous period of childhood disease. For all the turmoil in Anatolia over the preceding decades, there was no ongoing conflict. They were on good terms with the Antigonids over in Macedon. The eastern frontiers were quiet, and it certainly didn't look like Ptolemy Philadelphus would turn his focus back to Syria anytime soon. It was just about as stable as the empire had been at any point since Alexander the Great's invasion 70 years earlier. Now, this was partly due to the ongoing hostilities between Macedon and Egypt in the Cremonidean War. In 265, Antigonus II Gonatas gained the upper hand in the conflict, and by 261, he was just hammering on the Ptolemaic allies in Greece. The already limited Egyptian land presence in Europe was gone, and Ptolemaic naval dominance in the Aegean Sea had been broken. The pro-Ptolemy Athenians were under siege, and by most accounts, the Ptolemaic forces were finally destroyed just as Antiochus II came to power, with a naval battle near the island of Kos. But, as John D. Granger suggests in his book, The Rise of the Seleucid Empire, the Cremonidean War very plausibly might have ended so that Ptolemy could redirect his remaining strength to the east. In the Hellenistic tradition, and for most of Western world history, for that matter, treaties were not made between states. They were made between monarchs, and when a signatory king died, his treaties were nullified. Often, this just led to dignitaries going between courts and renewing any agreements on behalf of the new king. But sometimes, this was an opportunity to abandon an existing peace agreement, and both the new Antiochus and Ptolemy Philadelphus started making moves in that direction. If you remember, all the way back at the end of Antiochus I's reign, he was starting to make some subtle gains against Ptolemy in Anatolia with carefully orchestrated military deployments and agreements with individual city-states. But by oath, neither of them were really supposed to wage war against the other. So the one good thing, at least from his own perspective, that Antiochus II did not inherit, was an empire ready for full-scale war. Their standing forces were spread out across various trouble spots, and it took a long time to gather a full royal army from Central Asia all the way to the Levant. But starting that process seems to have been one of Antiochus's first royal decrees. Philadelphus, as much as he may have wanted to end the Syrian dispute quickly, was too busy with the Cremonidean War to act directly. Instead, he just focused on policies and appointments that could solidify Egyptian control over their occupied territories. Although it is partly a consequence of survivorship bias in our sources, we do see a serious increase in Ptolemaic consolidation of power in the disputed lands right at the start of Antiochus II's reign. New laws were issued to govern daily life, agricultural properties, and slavery, and trade in Ptolemaic Syria. New garrison cities were established to encourage pro-Ptolemaic immigration to Cilicia, like the new city of Arsinoe. In Lycia, the commander of the local Ptolemaic military, Pandaros, was celebrated with a statue and additional titles for his contributions to the local city. Most notably, Philadelphus stationed his immediate family members in powerful positions within Anatolia as soon as Antiochus Soter died. Two of the king's stepsons were sent in, Ptolemy Epigonos to Ephesus and Ptolemy Lysimachus to Telmessos in Lycia. Technically, both were Lysimachids, sons of the recently deceased Queen Arsinoe II and the late great Diadochus Lysimachus, but Epigonos, whose epithet literally just means the son, as in male offspring, got his nickname by virtue of being the most important of the stepsons that Philadelphus legally adopted. Ptolemy Epigonos was not just a prince sent to govern an important island. He was co-king, second only to Philadelphus himself. So now we have two sides, somewhat evenly matched in their preparation for war. The Ptolemies were closer and already on a war footing, but drained from the recent conflict in Europe. The Seleucids were spread out and needed time to gather their forces, but hadn't exhausted their resources in recent years. Then Ptolemy Epigonos went and mucked up the whole situation for everyone involved. Practically as soon as he was out from under his stepfather's immediate supervision, Epigonos made contact with Timarchus, the Ptolemaic general in command of everyone's favorite Ionian city-state, Miletus. So you know what that means. We've got another Milesian revolt in Ionia. Timarchus declared himself an independent tyrant. Miletus seceded from the Ptolemaic Empire, and Epigonus went into open revolt in late 260 or 259 BCE. It's not particularly well documented as rebellions go, and we don't really know what their goal was. From how events played out, I would guess that Epigonos wanted to seize power in Egypt, and offered Timarchus an independent kingdom, or at least an autonomous province, in exchange for his support. That's at least the impression I get from what they did next. We have a few isolated excerpts from what followed. Apparently, there was a battle where Timarchus sailed somewhere and burned his ships at anchor to force his own ground troops to fight to the death or victory. And cutting off their own retreat gave them the confidence and/or desperation to win. It's just not entirely clear who they were fighting at the time, because we get one sentence about this. Possibly the Ptolemaic garrison at Samos, because apparently Milesian forces defeated and killed the local garrison commander there, which led to Timarchus dressing up in his rival's Macedonian finery and sailing into the harbor under false pretenses to seize the city from within. These stories are, of course, in separate sources. The impression I get from those surviving accounts is that, despite being a relatively minor figure, Timarchus had a long-lasting reputation for strategic success and innovation. That probably helped him out when Epigonos told the Milesian tyrant to relocate his court to Ephesus. This is another reason that I think the plan was for Timarchus to become an autonomous dynast when the rebellion was done. Within the span of a year, the two rebels had given Timarchus effective control over three of the most important centers of power in southern Ionia, a strong basis for a little kingdom of his own. In Ionia, a strong basis for a kingdom of his own. The one thing that Epigonus did not count on was Timarchus deciding that, since he already had his kingdom, he didn't really need to be involved in Ptolemaic infighting. So he killed the crown prince and went back to his palace at Miletus as the new tyrant ruler of Samos, Ephesus, and Miletus. This did not work out for Telemachus. Both of the major powers surrounding him swooped in to deal with this breakaway statelet before it got out of hand. In 258, Antiochus II besieged Miletus's walls while his allies from Rhodes assaulted the Ephesian fleet guarding the harbor. At night, the Rhodians made a major push toward the city, very poorly attempting to attack the sea wall directly, but drawing the attention of not only the ships from Ephesus, but Telemachus's soldiers on the battlements. While everyone was distracted, Antiochus sent a contingent of his army out into the dark to circle back and attack a now undefended stretch of the walls, allowing the Seleucid forces to breach Miletus's defenses and take the city. They captured and killed Telemachus himself in the process. Evidently, the actual people of Miletus were not all that supportive of their tyrant to begin with, because they deified Antiochus in celebration for their liberation. This wasn't the coy giving divine titles like Soter that we've seen with other kings, or a traditional religious system like we see in Egypt. The Milesians went right to declaring their new monarch Antiochus Theos, Antiochus the God. Despite his newfound divinity, Antiochus did not directly press his advantage here. And with the rebel fleet broken and both of its primary leaders dead, Ptolemy Philadelphus made preparation to reoccupy the rebel islands. But now the stage was set, because Antiochus had just seized a very important city that had gone to the Ptolemies in the last peace treaty. He had intervened in Ptolemaic internal affairs without cause. Miletus was just important and vulnerable at the time, so the Seleucids took it, and with that, the Second Syrian War was off to the races. Hello, everybody. This is Trevor Cully, host of the History of Persia podcast. From about 550 to 330 BC, most of the Middle East was ruled by the Achaemenid Persians. The Achaemenids pioneered the concept of a truly multinational empire, which incorporated people from as far away as India and Greece for over 200 years. The story of Persia discusses the fall of ancient civilizations, the origins of endurance racing, 300 Spartans, the March of the 10,000, and at least one evil priest who replaced and impersonated the king, all before falling with the dramatic close at Alexander the Great's conquests. If that story, and the story of the cultures that surround it, sound interesting to you, check out The History of Persia at historyofpersiapodcast.com, or wherever you find your favorite podcasts. The first direct combat with Ptolemaic forces was actually something of a proxy battle. After reclaiming Samos, the Egyptian navy went to take Ephesus. Rhodes led the League of Islanders, at this time a coalition of Aegean islands that had turned against Ptolemaic dominance over the course of the Cremonidean War. apparently attempting to prevent Philadelphus from reclaiming more territory in the Aegean, they sailed out to meet Cremonides, the great Ptolemaic admiral at Ephesus. His Rhodian counterpart, Agathostratus, sailed out in a single ship right to the Ptolemaic line and then turned around, giving the impression of disorganization and retreat. It was a feigned withdrawal. As soon as he returned to his larger force, Agathostratus ordered the Rhodian navy to row at top speed in a tight formation directly at the Ptolemaic ships, just as they were making preparations to land on the island, to land on the coast. The initial confrontation was a disaster for the Ptolemies. They were caught completely unprepared for the attack and driven away after suffering heavy losses. With no rebellion and no Ptolemaic oversight, Seleucid forces made quick work of reclaiming Ephesus and Samos in the following years. Likewise, with the Ptolemaic navy effectively out of the fight entirely after significant losses at both Ephesus and Kos, Antiochus was able to rally his forces stationed in Anatolia and invade the regions of Pamphylia and Cilicia. This is where we get into some historical confusion. We're still in this early Hellenistic age where our sources are scattered, fragmentary, and do not usually provide firm dates. We know that Antiochus Theos and Antigonus Gonatus allied against Philadelphus. What we don't know is what Antigonus actually did to support the war effort. One distinct possibility is that the popularly held timeline of events in Greece is inaccurate, and that hostilities in southern Greece lasted for several years after the Antigonid army captured Athens. In that version of events, the Ptolemaic navy wasn't knocked out by the fight at Ephesus, but rather forced to redirect its efforts to Greece until the Battle of Kos that I mentioned earlier. In that view of events, the Antigonids shattered the Ptolemaic fleet in 255, not 261. However, the basic outline of events is the same. The Rhodians forced the Ptolemies to withdraw from the Anatolian coast, and the Antigonids dealt enough damage that the Egyptian navy was rendered useless in the Mediterranean. Events had progressed so quickly that the Seleucids were not really prepared for all-out war. Local forces had been standing ready to invade or defend the border with Ptolemy in Anatolia for decades. All those soldiers really had to do was leave their fortresses and march south. Without a fleet to bring supplies and reinforcements from Egypt, many Ptolemaic frontier garrisons would have been easy pickings. On the other hand, despite suffering significant setbacks, Ptolemy Philadelphus had two advantages in this fight. Egypt was, as always, ludicrously wealthy thanks to its immense agricultural base, mineral wealth, and easy access to trade in the Red Sea. The Egyptian population, and by extension the bulk of their army, was also much closer to Syria than most of the Seleucid manpower. So in 257, Ptolemy launched an invasion from the south. As with everything else in the Second Syrian War, we know very little about what exactly happened in either theater of the conflict. Aside from repelling some sort of Seleucid incursion, we know nothing about the Ptolemaic offensive in Syria. The general consensus is that they gained some ground, but there were no major transfers of power. A buried hoard of Ptolemaic coins from this period suggests that the Egyptian army encroached on the Seleucid capital district near Antioch, but there's not much else to indicate significant fighting in that region. Likewise, while the Seleucids gained ground in Pamphylia and Cilicia, neither of those regions was fully recaptured. Combat in Cilicia apparently shifted back and forth the most, with archaeological evidence of the Seleucids invading Ptolemaic territory, and of the Ptolemies pushing into the Seleucid-held parts of the same country. One battle, if we can call it that, that we know about, came when Antiochus hired Galatian mercenaries to support his local troops and mount an invasion of Lycia, which was defeated by the Egyptian general Neoptolemus near the city of Tlos. In Greece, Philadelphus sent money and arms to support rebellion in Corinth and Chalcis against the Antigonids, effectively threatening to reopen the Cremonidean War if Antigonus Gonatas did not withdraw his support for Antiochus. Gonatas was forced to make peace with Ptolemy in 254, and the war came to an end 1 year later, with a new peace treaty between Philadelphus and Antiochus Theos. The geographic details of this peace are hazy at best, and we are mostly left to rely on inscriptions from various towns in Anatolia to see which kings and nobles they reference in monuments, or archives in Egypt to see which local leaders got their orders from the Ptolemaic administration. In general, the Syrian border does not seem to have shifted very much, if at all. Despite Seleucid military success, Philadelphus actually gained land in Cilicia, but that came at a cost. Egyptian forces withdrew entirely from the western coast of the peninsula, greatly simplifying the lines between the disputed territories along more traditional provincial borders. Formally, this seems to have made Antiochus the victor. He at least got more of what he wanted in the geopolitical sense, but it was a bitter situation for him personally. Unrelated to the conflict, Antiochus's mother, Stratonike, died shortly before the end of hostilities. Then, to top it off, the Seleucid king was forced to divorce his wife, Laodike, and disinherit his children, including Seleucus, his son and heir apparent. In an amusing little aside, Pliny the Elder recorded a story that one of the old queen mother's last official acts involved a controversial painting of her. Apparently, an artist named Tesicles depicted her in a compromising position with a local fisherman, causing no small amount of controversy in Ephesus. But Stratonike ordered it not to be taken down, because of, quote, the likeness of the two figures being admirably expressed. Tesicles had already fled town out of fear, but apparently, old Queen Stratonike, who had lost most of her hair to some sort of disease at this point, found the depiction of her own nudity quite flattering. Anyway, back to politics. Traditionally speaking, the superior king, or the victor in a war, got the favorable end of a marriage pact. Generally, that meant marrying a princess from the other side, and that is what happened in the Second Syrian War. But Philadelphus still had a pretty strong negotiating position. He offered peace and would seal the deal by wedding his daughter Berenike to Antiochus. Antiochus's position as the political victor was further reinforced by a massive war indemnity disguised as Berenike's dowry, to the point that she was remembered by history as Berenike the Dowry Bringer. However, this Egyptian princess and her future children could not be secondary figures in the Seleucid court. For this peace to be worthwhile, Berenike's sons needed to be first in line for the succession. So, by treaty, Antiochus was required to divorce Laodike, which also effectively downgraded Seleucus in the order of inheritance. To the king's credit, he handled this about as well as he could, and it's very clear that this was all politics. Antiochus made Laodike immensely wealthy and powerful in her own right, a position we do not often see from the Greco-Macedonian noblewomen of this era. She was given exclusive rights to extensive tracts of land and massive estates in Anatolia, and she retained all of the privileges associated with being a royal landlord. Only the king himself could contradict her financial or real estate dealings, and the implication is that Antiochus himself had no intention of doing that. In fact, Antiochus the god only occasionally even tried to hold up his end of the treaty. Berenike would not carry a pregnancy to term for years after the end of the Second Syrian War, and in the meantime, Antiochus just went back to living with Laodike and their two sons, obviously favoring his ex-wife. Ptolemy Philadelphus spent the final years of his reign repeatedly begging and/or demanding that Antiochus honor their agreement and actually act like Berenike's husband to little avail. This episode is pretty short, but I have no doubt that trying to cover more ground in one episode will spiral wildly out of control, because the next segment I have planned is foreign and not-so-foreign relations under Antiochus Theos. And there's just no way to cover half a dozen separate kingdoms, two rebellions, a Seleucid offensive in Europe, and the Second Syrian War all in one episode. So that will have to wait. Until then, if you want more information about this podcast, you can go to hopfulmedia.com. That's where you'll find things like my bibliography, episode imagery, and additional resources. If you want to hear more of my voice, you can listen to America Secret Wars, where I tell my friends and guests the story of forgotten and overlooked conflicts in American history. And if you want to support my projects, you can go to hopfulmedia.com.co to donate, buy merch, or subscribe to get access to ad-free listening and bonus content. If you don't want to spend money on me, that's absolutely fine. The best ways to support a project like this are to share on social media or leave reviews on your podcast app of choice. So review on Apple, rate on Spotify, and you can find me on Blue Sky at History of Persia and on Instagram at History of Persia Podcast. Until next time, thank you all so much for listening to The History of Persia.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East, the very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.